This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the show. Today is part three in a series we've been doing with Dr. BJ Leeper all about how to prevent and treat triathlon injuries. Back on episode 108, we talked about leg injuries. On episode 120, we talked about arm and shoulder injuries. And now we'll wrap the series up here in episode 132, talking about maintaining a healthy core. Joining us for this is Dr. BJ Leeper. BJ graduated from the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with a doctorate in physical therapy and rehabilitation science. He's a board-certified orthopedic specialist, a certified strength and conditioning specialist, and a USA Triathlon Level 1 coach. He specializes in comprehensive movement testing and is an avid triathlete himself with over 50 tries under his belt. So BJ, are you ready to get our abs and our core rocking today, my friend?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking maybe I should use a Jeff Rains pun and absolutely.
Absolutely.
But why would I want to do that? It's just corny. But excited to chat about this. There's a lot of interesting things to cover here. So looking forward to it.
Next up is pro triathlete and coach Elizabeth James. Elizabeth is a USAT Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach who quickly rose through the triathlon ranks using TriDot, from a beginner to top age grouper to a professional triathlete. She's a Kona and Boston Marathon qualifier who has coached triathletes with TriDot since 2014. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
You know, this is just my pleasure. We've gotten some really good feedback about the first two episodes in this series, and I know that today is going to be another great conversation. Just as we continue to look to provide athletes with some good information about keeping their bodies healthy and injury-free so that they can keep training.
I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up questions, settle in for our main set topic, and then wind things down with our cool down. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Kind of putting a fun twist on today's warm-up question as a sort of thought experiment, we're going to do a triathlon would you rather. BJ, Elizabeth, would you rather race your next multi-sport event, one, wearing baggy clothes during the swim leg, two, wearing run shoes and not being able to clip in for the bike leg, or three, wearing bowling alley bowling shoes for the run leg? You have to pick one of the three for your next race. Which would you rather have to do? BJ Leeper.
Oh man, I was not even prepared for this. I feel like it's not even a question though, is it? I mean, who would not choose to just use run shoes instead of not clipping in? I don't know. I guess it depends on the distance, but I definitely wouldn't go baggy clothes on the swim and bowling alley bowling shoes would be miserable for the run leg. Although I do have big feet and I usually have the freshest pair of bowling shoes when I go to the bowling alley because nobody wears size 14 hardly.
Oh.
So, but I'd still have to go run shoes. I mean, hands down for sure.
Okay. So you would rather wear run shoes and just kind of put them on the platform pedals and just have to pedal without clipping in for the bike like that. That's what you're going with here.
Yeah, I mean, even for a longer distance race, it wouldn't be ideal, but I'd pick it over the other two for sure.
All right, pro triathlete Elizabeth James, which of these three would you rather have to do for your next multi-sport event?
I'm definitely thinking along the same lines as BJ there. When you first said it, I was like, well, I wonder what distance. Like, you know, maybe for like a super sprint try, I could get by with baggy clothes for like a 200-meter swim or 300-meter swim, but I think overall, no matter what distance, I would rather wear just regular run shoes and not be able to clip in the bike than those other two options. Gosh, wearing bowling alley shoes just sounds like a disaster waiting to happen. But I mean, slip and fall and for me, the swim is already hard.
I want to know who would actually choose that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Who would actually choose that? The bowling shoes. I want to know if we have a listener that would actually choose that. I want to know who they are.
Well, we're going to find out, because we're going to throw this question out to our audience and see what they have to say. I think for me, I would rather do the swimming in baggy clothes. And I
really?
Get that would be miserable. I get it would weigh you down. I get it would slow you down, but I'm already slower at the swim anyway. So, I mean, while I'm falling behind on that leg, I might as well fall just a little bit further behind and then be happy on the bike and run. The thing with the swim is it's also the shortest leg of the race. And so if I'm slowing myself down for the shortest leg of the race, I've got much longer on the bike to be happy and not be miserable, just with, tennis running shoes. What it sounds, because I do expect when we throw this out to the audience that most people will agree with you too. I really do. And so I'm almost wondering, like, should I have made the bike option less appealing? Like, should I have said, like, maybe you have to bike barefoot on your pedals? Or maybe I could have made the run one less miserable by, instead of bowling shoes, just said, like, non-running shoes. Like, you can use whatever shoes you want. They just can't be actual running shoes. I don't know. There's probably some other things I could have mixed in here to make the three equally miserable, as opposed to making maybe the bike a little bit more feasible, because I mean, plenty of people already do that. When they're new to the sport, you don't have the clipless pedals yet, and so that's already a viable way to bike. So maybe this one's on me for making this one too easy. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I was thinking, yeah, like I've already done that.
Right. I think we need to clarify the baggy clothes.
Yes. Okay. And Andrew, does it change your answer if you have to do that for a full Ironman?
Ooh, I don't know that it does, because
really?
I don't want to ride 112 miles wearing without being clipped in. I mean, you just gain so much more to every pedal stroke. I've said on the podcast before, I don't want to ride my bike any longer than I have to. So that swim is long and slow for me. So it, I mean, what's the problem of making it a little bit longer and a little bit slower?
See, I'd be worried I wouldn't make the swim cut off with baggy clothes.
Yeah, I'm picturing on the baggy clothes, somebody wearing like this loose windbreaker jacket on the swim and like these baggy sweatpants. I'm like, that would just be miserable. Uh-huh.
But say, say it takes my swim split from 120 to 150. I'm not going to lose 30 minutes on the bike by wearing tennis shoes. I don't think. So that's my, we'll see when we throw this out to our audience, if I'm the only one picking that, I might be in the minority. And we'll see if anybody out there is just wild enough to say, you know what? I like bowling. Let's try the bowling shoes. So guys, as always, we will throw this out to you. Make sure you're a part of the I Am Trot Facebook group. And, the Monday that this episode comes out, we're going to throw this question out. Would you rather race your next multi-sport event, number one, wearing baggy clothes for the swim, number two, wearing just normal shoes, not being able to clip in for the bike, or wearing bowling shoes during the run leg of your event? Can't wait to see what you have to say.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
This show is brought to you by Precision Fuel and Hydration, who have a wide range of tools and products to help you personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so that you can perform at your best. Longtime listeners of the show will know them as Precision Hydration, but they've changed their name to reflect the fact that they've been helping athletes nail both aspects of their performance for a long time now. Everyone sweats differently, and the amount of fuel we require varies depending on factors like duration and intensity of our activity, so a one-size-fits-all approach to fueling and hydration just doesn't cut it. Head to precisionfuelandhydration.com and use their free online sweat test and quick carb calculator to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs during training and racing. Then you can book a free one-on-one video consultation with the team to refine your hydration and fueling strategy for your upcoming race. As a listener of the show, you can get 10% off your first order of fueling and hydration products by using the code TRIDOT10 at the checkout. And once again, that's precisionfuelandhydration.com. Combining three sports that spin our extremities around and around, we probably are more worried about injuries to our arms and legs than we are to our core. But the core is the center from which all other movement flows. So keeping it healthy and happy is vital to success in tri training. Good thing today we have Dr. BJ Leeper and pro triathlete Elizabeth James here to talk about taking care of your core. So as we get started talking about core health, BJ, Elizabeth, have either of y'all ever dealt with core injuries in your time in athletics?
Well, I think before we even jump into that, I mean, one of the first things to establish here is that your core isn't just your abdominal muscles. And I think that this is a very, very common misconception. So like core work isn't just crunches, you know, it's strengthening the middle of your body, kind of from your chest down through the mid thigh. And therefore, core injuries aren't just, you know, an injury to that six pack either. They can involve pain in the hips, glutes, low back. And so, you know, having established that it's more than the abs, yes, definitely. I've had some core injuries in my time in athletics. In high school, I had issues, and I know it's kind of like a colloquial name for it, but it's called like snapping hip syndrome, where it's like the muscles and the tendons that are near the hip bones just come very, very tight. And they kind of like when you move, they snap over that like hip's bony protrusion on the side.
Yikes.
Yeah, it sounds gross. And then, I mean, my hip flexors have given me a number of troubles. I've struggled for a long time with just kind of this major anterior pelvic tilt. And that's where like my hip flexors are so incredibly tight that it kind of pulls my pelvis out of alignment and really inhibits the correct firing and recruitment of my glutes. So yeah, when we talk about core injuries, like I've been there, still kind of there. So yeah, something I can definitely speak to.
BJ, were you tracking with everything Elizabeth just said?
Oh yeah. And it's really common. And she brings up a great point. Like when we talk about the core, it's not just your abs. I mean, most people use those two interchangeably, but when we're talking about the core as we're discussing today, it's really a region. And I like to use, we'll talk about this a little bit more as we go, but I like to use the analogy of a box of muscles where you've got the top of the box, the bottom of the box, back and sides. And like when we're talking about the core with that, you know, analogy, the back of the box is where we talk about a lot of injuries. And I'm right in that category in my history. I've probably mentioned it on this podcast before, but just had a bad back injury in high school playing football, where I herniated a disc and my lower back. And, you know, and when that affects you in that way with the pain I had, you know, it was a moment where I could, or time period where I could hardly walk. It was excruciating to sneeze or to cough, and by far one of the most painful experiences I've ever had. So, and we see it all the time in the clinic, back injuries, core injuries, whatever you want to call it. It's a very common problem and definitely very common in triathlon too.
Well, it's interesting that for both of you, your primary experiences with core injuries go back to youth team sports and not to endurance sports. You know, we'll kind of learn here that we've learned in our previous episodes of this series that most triathlon-related injuries are lower quarter. Upper quarter injuries, you know, are much rarer than lower quarter injuries. So BJ, even for the three of us in this podcast, it seems like our injuries are team sport related from our past. So how about our core in relation to triathlon? You know, what percentage of endurance athletes will have problems in the center of our body?
And it tends to be very, very similar to the general athletic population too. And a lot of it's because we're all active people. And a lot of us did play sports when we were younger. And like we always say, that one of the biggest predictors of future injury is previous injury. And a lot of us have had previous injuries in that area, and it correlates to that for future potentially. But, you know, when we try to look at the research of what's out there with regards to the specific triathlon population, there's not a lot. It's kind of convoluted. You'll see some percentages there of some studies that have been looking at that where, like you said, Andrew, the highest percentage is in the lower quarter. But you'll see on average, at least 20% of triathletes deal with lower back pain or areas in the core. And I've seen studies even show that closer to 75%. And I tend to believe it's much closer to that as well. Those people,
BJ, who have had back pain at all, they're at home right now, or they're in their car, or they're wherever they're listening. You know, on their bike trainer, maybe, you know, they're nodding their head like, yep, if you've dealt with back pain, you know, you've dealt with back pain, and you know how debilitating or how worrying back pain can be.
Yeah. And we see it all the time. And anecdotally, you know, in the clinic, 90% of the patients I'll see are related to spine related injuries, knee or shoulder, and the largest percentage of that being in the around the spine. So I think in the triathlon community, it's very common. Exact numbers, it's hard to say, but like many of us have experienced with regards to the back area or core related area, we know it's affected us in some way, shape or form, and definitely probably impacted our training or racing in triathlon.
So as Elizabeth was mentioning at the beginning of our conversation, yeah, a lot of folks, I think, just think abs. They think that six pack, that eight pack, you know, if you're really jacked like we all are, right? And we might think of our back when we say core. But BJ, as we chat today, I love kind of the illustration you guys already gave just by thinking of it as a box, you know, with the front of the box, the back of the box. You know, BJ, kind of catch us up from a PT's perspective. When we say core, what all is our core that we'll be talking about here today?
Yeah, and we'll get into the anatomical definition of what I term the core. But I think the first place to start with all of it is really defining what is core stability or what is core strength, because it's really very complex. It's much more than just the abs, like we've already referenced. But the definition I've really liked of what core stability truly is that core stability is the instantaneous integrity of our pelvis and spine in the presence of full range of motion. And so there's a lot there, but if we break that down, that core stability is the instantaneous integrity. What that means to me is that core stability is not something that you just actively, consciously contract and do all the time, right? It's something that's spontaneous. It's instantaneous. It's reflexive. It's something that's part of your subconscious timing system. And that's a key thing we'll get into in a little bit. But then the other part of that definition of the core stability being the instantaneous integrity of our pelvis and spine in the presence of full range of motion, that second part of that definition, in the presence of full range of motion, or what we could consider like normal flexibility or full mobility, that's a key component of the core, because in the presence of stiffness, or if there's tightness in the system, your brain will not communicate to those core stabilizers in the correct way. There's a misfiring or mistiming of those muscles stabilizing the right way. So core is, it's critical that there's functional mobility or normal mobility in those areas around the core in order for your core to fire correctly. So if we start with that definition of what truly is core stability, it's very much tied to timing. It's the right muscle, the right time. And then we get into the anatomy of what muscles are involved in that stabilization process. And that's when we can kind of get into things that are maybe a little bit more understandable as far as like, oh, I've heard of that muscle before. But if we lay out the picture of the core as that box, so think of this analogy of a box, and really we have four layers of abdominal musculature alone that makes up that box. But the top of that box involves the diaphragm, which is kind of known as our breathing muscle. The bottom of that box is our pelvic floor musculature, which we don't often think of as a core muscle, but it really is part of that system. And the front of the box is what most people look at when they consider the core, and that's our rectus abdominis. That's, you know, our eight-pack abs. The external internal obliques kind of make up the sides of the box. The transverse abdominis is kind of this internal corset muscle that's like the back brace or the brace of our internal system. It's highly critical. Hip flexors, like Elizabeth alluded to, is also part of this system. And in the back of that box, we've got our paraspinal muscles. There's a small muscle called your multifidus, which is a highly specified muscle for stability that we talk about a lot. And then your lats and your glutes kind of make up this, what we call this posterior sling, where your left lat kind of feeds into the fascial layers of your right glute and vice versa on the left side. So all that said, the core is really a complex system made up of a lot of layers, a lot of different muscles, which makes it such a really powerful system and really specialized system.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful to, I mean, really envision it as that box and for you to kind of go through and say, okay, yeah, we're not just talking about, and I love how you used the 8-pack abs instead of the 6-pack abs that Andrew and I were referring to. You can tell who's been working on their core even more.
we'll raise it to 12 by the time this episode's
over.
There
we go.
Yeah. I've got a 12-pack over here. And we're gonna...
but yeah, I mean, things like, you know, the lats, the glutes, the hip flexors, the diaphragm, I mean, those are all needing to be considered. And so from everything that you've just said and kind of, you know, those specific muscles that you mentioned, what are the threats here for kind of core injuries as a triathlete? What would you say are kind of some of the main things that you've seen as a threat?
Yeah, the biggest threat to the system is really in the triathlon world is really the pattern that we as triathletes kind of get locked into. And that's largely the sagittal plane, which is kind of the front to back plane where like we're running, we're moving a leg forward and back, cycling, same thing. So it's that front to back movement or what we consider the sagittal plane. And this kind of takes me back to really the impetus of how I got on this track of really studying triathletes and really wanting to improve triathlon performance from a human movement standpoint and mobility and strength standpoint. It was about 15 years ago. I had just gotten into the sport of triathlon and I was in Oceanside, California at a seminar. And I think I've shared part of this story before, but I was at a seminar and I was listening to this, one of the most world renowned PTs, discuss a lot of different topics. But after the seminar, there were just a handful of us, maybe four or five, just sitting around talking to this guy. And he also owned his own clinic. He was a PT, he was on a seminar circuit, spoke a lot, but he also ran his own practice and treated patients regularly. And we were all just curious. We're like, you know, hey, on a Friday night at 5 o'clock, like last patient of the day, who's the last type of patient you would want to see walk through your doors? And he literally did not even bat an eye. He just said, a triathlete or an ultra runner. And I was new to the sport. I was so offended because I was like really into triathlon. I'm like, what? Why would you say that? But his main
and
factor,
you know, for him to respond instantly, you know, and not have to think about that means he's dealt with triathletes or ultra runners and had a bad experience.
Exactly.
So that he can just recall that quickly.
Yeah. And I gathered in talking to him, like there were two points to that. The first point was that, you know, triathletes tend to be type A and don't want to give up their training. You know, they're slaves to their training, which tends to be true in my experience as well. but the other big factor, and like we're talking about here, the biggest threat to triathletes is that we are sagittal plane beasts, so to speak. And that's what he alluded to. Like we train so many hours of our day in this sagittal plane of movement, and we don't often mix it up with complementary training or supplemental strength and conditioning to balance us out. So we get into this pattern of sagittal plane overuse, and we know that 75% of triathlon injuries are due to overuse. And so with the threat we're talking about here, threats to our core system, Elizabeth already touched on it as a problem she's experiencing herself, which is that anteriorly tilted pelvis, or what we call lower cross syndrome, where hip flexors get tight, your lower back gets tight. That's a diagonal pattern that relates to each other. The opposite or the antithesis of that pattern is your anterior core and your posterior glutes. And so the glutes and the core, we often call the king and the queen of the body. Because they are that powerful and they have that relationship where the glutes often are considered the core or the king, not because they're necessarily priority over the core or the anterior core like we talk about a lot, but because they are so powerful. But if you think about that, if I'm at a position with my pelvis is tilted forward and I've got hyperactive hip flexors, and as a result, my lower back is also hyperactive, I could have the best 10-pack abs, right? Known to man.
There we go.
I could have the
up
best glute strength known to man. Right. We're just going to up it every time. So I could have literally the best core strength and glute strength known to man. But if I'm out of position with my pelvis because I'm so lower crossed, it doesn't matter how good my strength is there, I'm not going to be able to use those muscles efficiently or at all for that matter. And I've seen a lot of people that drive their system, so to speak, from those two areas, hip flexors and lower back, and elite triathletes even that perform at a very high level, but still are not tapping into the king and the queen. And some that even come off the bike and they can't finish a run because their back is so tied up. Their hip flexors are so hyperactive, they can't get out of it. And they end up walking the run or they have to pull out. So I think that is the biggest threat, just really the overall principle that we are sagittally plane driven athletes as triathletes, and we have to figure out ways to balance that. And some of us have more problems with that than others.
So when we talked about leg injuries and shoulder injuries, a reoccurring theme is how injuries in our limbs can actually originate in our core. So BG, now that we're solely focused on the core and we've identified that main threat of overuse and getting our system out of whack and the timing out of whack, you know, talk to us about how our core interacts with our limbs.
Yeah, and this is a great question because it is, like we've already talked about, a timing issue. It's the right muscle at the right time. So in isolation, all of these muscles we're talking about that are part of our core can be strong individually. But if we're not able to position the pelvis correctly, like we just talked about, or we're not able to transfer energy from the core to a limb, like you're kind of asking here, it doesn't matter how strong those individual muscles are. I always like this analogy of a 4x400 meter relay where you're passing the baton. You could have the fastest 400 meter individual sprinters in the world. If they drop the baton, they lose. And that's what we're talking about here is how efficiently can your body pass the baton? And it all starts with the core. If your core is set up correctly and you've got the proper timing of all these muscles we're describing, then you are able to pass the baton and transfer that energy from upper quarter to lower quarter or through the lower quarter to the pedal or to the ground as you're running. So it's all about that energy transfer. But again, if it doesn't fire correctly, if that motor control is off or the core isn't firing at the right time, then you lose. That dynamic motor control is lost. And there's actually a lot of research on this, especially with regards to people that have experienced injury in their core. And a lot of the research is tied to lower back injury, where there's a specific sequencing of firing that happens with those smaller muscles, like we were talking about, the transverse abdominis and some of those multifidus muscles that are these smaller intrinsic core stabilizers. They've done studies that have shown that in the presence of pain or athletes that have had a history of pain, those muscles fire a split second after you've already moved a limb. So the natural timing of that sequence is when you are planning a movement in your mind, your brain is communicating to your limb to take a step or to grab something with your arm or hand, your core will actually fire subconsciously a split second before you move a limb. And that's just your natural way of stabilizing itself before you go to transfer energy. However, in the presence of pain, that sequence gets reversed. So basically what happens is you go to move a limb and then your core all of a sudden is like a second thought, like, oh, we forgot to stabilize. Okay, we got it now. But that split second difference is where a lot of injuries can happen to the lower back and the discs and things like that.
Well, and particularly with these movements that we do where it's repetitive just over and over and over again,
exactly.
You know, stepping
exactly.
While we're running.
So if you have that and it's exponentially magnified because you're firing instead of 1-2 firing sequence, you're going 2-1. And even if it's just for a split second, that dysfunction can get magnified over the course of however multiple strides you're taking, however multiple pedal strokes you're taking. So that's definitely a huge area, the timing and the sequencing, and it definitely is involved there.
That's so interesting to think of it as like the 1-2 and 2-1. I've never even thought about it that way. As an athlete that's sitting here listening to this and they're like, wow, like that's fascinating. I want to make sure that I'm not in that 2-1 firing pattern. How can you fix that? How can you fix the timing of like the firing of the core system so that they don't put themselves at risk of injury?
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to say it's as simple as just do a bunch of crunches, you know. But it's really more
complicated. Hold a plank for 21 minutes.
Yeah, just plank. Work on the 12 pack, right?
See, now we're up to 12.
We're up to 12. Yep. Keep counting at home.
When you get to the point that you have a 13 pack, you'll have no more issues with this timing system.
Yeah, exactly. The interesting thing about all this, obviously it's complex, but the reality is most of the body's stability occurs at 20% of max capacity, which what that means is that by the time, like if you're loading your system, whatever it might be, lifting weights or moving with energy transfer, by the time you get to the 20% mark of max capacity, everything that you do from there on out is going to magnify how well you either did or didn't fire your core stabilizers correctly. And remember, this is a system that's spontaneous. It's not something that you're thinking about as, okay, I'm going to start to stride out with my run, I better fire my abs. It's something that's just happening without you being aware. But if that system is off, like we just described, that's already happening at 20% of max capacity, and then it's magnified beyond that by how much load or how much force you're exerting through the body. So what you really have to do is you have to understand that's what the process is, and know that you can easily train that system, but there's some steps you have to consider to get that training done correctly. So it doesn't require just max exertional exercise. It can be done at low intensity. It's just like the example of passing the baton. Like, how much exertion does it take to work on those? You know, if you ever ran track, you work on the baton passing drills of stick, and you know, you're swinging your arms and you hold out your hand to the next person, and it's a skilled drill. It's not that requires, you know, smoking yourself running a 400, but that's part of the keys. It's kind of like what we're talking about. You have to train the timing. And so when we go through the timing sequence, not to get too long-winded, but there's really kind of four basic steps if you want to consider it. And it almost sounds like you're going to a self-help group where the first step is like, okay, first step, acknowledge that there's a problem, right? Because number one is subconscious dysfunction. So you don't even know that you have a misfiring system in your core. You don't even know that your core timing is off. But the reality is you've got this dysfunction or this pattern or this compensation, we could even call it, where a lot of times in the clinic we'll say lights are on but nobody's home, where you have a muscle like Elizabeth's hip flexor analogy or example, where hip flexors are tight. Like even at rest, you might be sitting there and you know your hip flexors are extremely tight and there's no reason they need to be on, but because they're so used to being overutilized and they're compensating for something, that you've got these lights on but nobody's home, and you have to acknowledge, or you have to come to realization that that's actually happening. And that's largely where the reset work we talk all the time about within PT or chiropractic or any type of care, where the main focus of getting those resets is to inhibit that tone that's compensating, that's on. The lights are on but nobody's home. It's, you know, we got to go around and flip all the lights off because we know there's no reason that they need to be on. You're just sitting there, you're supported by a chair, yet your hip flexors are engaged thinking they need to be your core supporting you. And that's where things like foam rolling, vibration, massage, dry needling, all these types of modalities can come into play to help turn those things off. But again, that's the core problem. So it's recognizing that. And then that's really step two is conscious dysfunction. So once you're aware of when that is happening, you can feel that or know, oh yeah, this is what's happening. Like we talk about this in the clinic a ton with the neck pain. A lot of people have tied upper traps, and like for the example in triathlon, I see this a lot, where somebody's riding a bike and they're in aero and their upper traps are on fire because they're trying to be your core stabilizing you. And again, it's lights are on but nobody's home. There's no reason that the neck needs to be on in those situations, but because the core is maybe misfiring or not timing right, you're sitting there in aero and you're riding your bike and your abs are on all the time, or your upper traps are on like your abs all the time. So once you can recognize that in your system, you can start to have this conscious control, or, you know, you're recognizing the conscious dysfunction, and you notice that and you can say, oh yeah, my neck's on, turn my neck off, relax my neck. Okay. Relax shoulders, let my core fire. Let myself breathe more through my diaphragm or my belly as I'm cycling. So there's all kinds of different tricks to start to then work into that process. But again, self-assessment and even movement screening can help make you more aware of that dysfunction. And that's another big step to correcting it. And then that's when we can get into the third and fourth steps, which are conscious function. So once you can correct it, then you can consciously, this is kind of where our strength and conditioning comes in, where we have exercises where we are conscious of what we're doing. We can achieve what we need to do in activating our core correctly. And we start to train that through different drills to get this reflexive stabilization. And there's a lot of different techniques for that. And then you can start to feel when it's right versus when it's wrong. And then when you can feel that you've trained it consciously, it starts to trickle over into your subconscious where you don't have to think about it. It just happens. And that's when you know you've arrived and that pattern has now stuck, where you've changed a pattern. You know you're now firing in that 1-2 sequencing. And there's ways to screen for that. But again, it's like that 4-step process of subconscious dysfunction. Okay, finding out there's a problem, acknowledging it. Now you've got conscious dysfunction. Okay, training that out. You know how to do a certain drills that you can actually turn that dysfunctional system off and engage your core functionally. That's the conscious function. And then you train that enough to where it turns into subconscious function. So it's a long-winded answer, but in essence, again, it's complicated, but there's definitely a sequence that you can train effectively to get out of it.
Part of me being a high injury prone athlete is no matter what injury we seem to talk about on the podcast, I've got a story where I've struggled with that part of my body. And I certainly shared some stories on the upper quarter episode and on the lower quarter episode. And so here's my story for the core episode. And I share it because it goes hand in hand with what you're saying, BJ. Years ago, when I was a young 20 something, my brother and I in the Dallas area lived in nearby apartment complexes. And, you know, we both actually around the same time period injured our backs. When I say injured our backs, my brother had an event. He was moving from one apartment to another. He picked up a heavy box. He turned with that heavy box in his hands and he felt a pop in his back and had searing pain that lasted for days and days until he could get checked out. I, around the same time period, I was just a runner. I was trying to just stay in shape by running. And I noticed in a lot of my runs, my back, my lower back in particular, was just wearing out. If I would get to a steep enough hill or a big enough hill, or if I was, you know, getting 4 miles, 5 miles into a run, like my back was just giving out to the point that I had to stop and walk when I was well capable of running that distance. And it was weird to me. So I, with both those things happening at the same time, my brother and I go to the same doctor together. We both got x-rayed. We both got screened. We both got prescribed to a physical therapist. And the physical therapist took a look at both of us. And basically what he explained to me, he was like, your brother has an injury. You know, he slipped a disc. We've got to get that addressed with him in a certain way. You do not have an injury. You just need to address that part of your body and get that part of your body strong again. And basically he was like, with the running you're doing, with the gym work you're doing, you know, you're brushing your teeth right now, but I need to teach you how to floss, was the analogy he gave me. I need to teach you how to work out that part of your body, how to get that part of your body strong so that when you're running, you know, your running is supported by a proper core. And so, you know, my brother went to physical therapy for a couple months. I went to physical therapy for a couple weeks. You know, he showed me a couple routines. He showed me some core exercises. And really, BJ, in hindsight, he didn't say this. He didn't talk about the system firing correctly and the 1-2 versus the 2-1. But looking back on it, he was basically helping me get my system firing correctly. And for me, just so long as I do some of those back exercises he taught me and keep that system firing correctly, I stay relatively healthy with my lower back. And as soon as I stop doing those exercises, I feel my back starting to get tight. So I say all that to say, for somebody at home, they listen to this episode, you know, they feel some back tightness, they feel some core discomfort somewhere in a workout. You know, how can we identify if the pain in our core or back is due to an injury versus just needing to get our system firing correctly again?
Well, the short answer is that it's often hard to tell, because many people that are having some of those, like you're saying, misfiring issues and having some discomfort, not necessarily due to a really acute event like your brother had, a lot of times people have had micro trauma to their back or micro injury where they weren't really even aware of it, but they were having some subtle injuries over the course of time. But the reality is it doesn't necessarily matter, because the solution to both of those problems is roughly the same. Because whether you've had a real traumatic event or whether you've had gradual kind of mistiming over the course of time because of a minor injury that you didn't even realize was happening, your system still is off and it needs to be corrected. And the similar solutions are for those potentially two different problems. So honestly, the solution might be the same. And like in your case with your brother, like both of you need to be flossing, so to speak. But
yeah.
But the bottom line is, if somebody is struggling with the feeling of tightness in their lower back or hip flexors, most likely there is a motor control issue, an improper timing issue of the core. And for some people, they've been patterned for a very, very, very long time. And by the time they actually start to take notice of something, it may have been years that was actually happening. But they just never had pain to bring it to surface. And that's what we see a lot of times in the clinic, is that people come in, they start feeling pain in their back and they think like, what did I even do? And sometimes it's nothing that they did at that moment, but it's over the course of time, just your body starts to find a way and it works around an issue. And so again, it starts to do that compensation where it's a subconscious dysfunction. You're not aware that it's happening until it becomes a significant problem. And this is my big disclaimer for why I think it's important that we all, from a muscle and movement standpoint, we all should be getting screened more periodically. Just like you go into the dentist and you have your prophylactic checkups when nothing is wrong in your mind, just to make sure that everything looks okay and you get your x-rays and your images. I think we need that in human movement, screening the muscles, screening the joints, screening our patterns, just to make sure that our bodies are okay before it does become a problem.
I would absolutely second that, because I mean, my issues with the hip flexors and the anterior pelvic tilt, I mean, I've been compensating for years and years and years, and it hasn't been until, I mean, over these past couple of years that I've even noticed that and then been able to address it. But now I'm fighting, I mean, a long period of time of bad habits. And so, you know, had there been a screening or an opportunity to identify that earlier, I'm sure it would be a lot easier to go through some of that reset process than it is now of breaking those habits and really having to work very hard to, one, even recognize what was going on. And I can tell you, I'm still not at that subconscious, you know, function where we still got to think about it to make sure things are firing correctly. So yeah, I'll put in my second opinion.
Present day Elizabeth needed past Elizabeth to have learned all of this a long time ago, unfortunately.
Yes. Yeah. But hey, now we're going to save people, you know, from making that same problem.
Yeah.
So glad to be here and putting that knowledge out now. I guess kind of, you know, moving on from that, I think one of the questions that I have gotten so frequently as a coach, you know, we talk all the time about the importance of, let's make sure we're strengthening the core. And they're like, well, how do I do that? So BJ, what would you say, you know, on the muscular level, what exercises do we need to do to strengthen our core? How would you answer that question for a triathlete?
Yeah. And the first part is like exactly what we were talking about before, is knowing your deficits, knowing if there's a timing issue. And sometimes there are things you have to go through to realize that outside of, you're just in pain all the time, right? So assuming you're not in pain, like how do you know if you've got a core function or different things like that. And I think the way we address that is we do have to look at normal fundamental patterns of movement. And then assuming that those patterns are functional and normal, then when we're talking about strengthening our core, so we're going to assume for the moment that you're moving well, you're firing well. One of the best ways to strengthen that system or strengthen your core firing is to think about exercises that focus on patterns and not parts. So, you know, isolating strength and parts is great for bodybuilders, but most athletes and triathletes included need to be able to move. And so if I had to go to one pattern that would strengthen our core and be probably the best pattern we can make sure stays clean and we load and we strengthen, is going to be a fundamental pattern that I just consider our hip hinge. And for most people, they think, when they think of hip hinge, they think deadlift, and it's in that category of deadlift types of movements. But if you think about it, one of the primary movement patterns we've had since we developed from an infant and getting into the ability to walk, before you could walk, before you could even squat, you developed your hip hinge. I love, you know, as I went through PT school and then took more courses and developed as a PT, I started then with my kids as they're growing up, like testing these theories. I'm like, there's these theories of development of how we develop naturally, that like we don't have to reinvent the wheel with machines and crazy apparatuses to strengthen us. Like, nature knows best how to develop us from when we were an infant to when we started to walk. And if you were to roll like a toddler, if you were to roll them a significant amount of weight, let's say it was like a 10 pound or an 8 pound medicine ball or something, you rolled it to a toddler and had them pick it up, almost always they would drop down like into a rock bottom squat. They would bring the weight close to themselves and then they'd throw their butt up in the air and they'd hip hinge that weight to stand up with it. They wouldn't squat that weight to stand up. You know, at some point down the road, we all got in this box of lift with your legs, not your back. You can't, you know, hinge at the hips or bend your back. It'll hurt your back. But naturally, that's not how we move. We don't move that way. We move [S2] Wow. [S1] With a developed hip hinge. And that's where our glutes, the king, are most at an advantage to work for us, is through a hip hinge. And so getting back to the question of what are some of the best exercises to strengthen our core, we have to tap into our hip hinge to start that process. And so I'm a big proponent of hip hinge work, deadlift work, where I like to make sure first that somebody has a fundamental pattern of a hip hinge. So if you're really tight, you can't even get close to touching your toes, or you can't hinge at your hips to save your soul, there's no way we're going to start to significantly load that. We have to go after that pattern first. So again, you have to have a requisite range of motion, requisite mobility, and then we can start to load that pattern into those deadlift type movements. And specifically for the world of triathlon, the single leg deadlift is one of my favorites, because remember, when you've got two legs down, so you're doing a bilateral deadlift, it's very much still that sagittal plane drive, right? But when you take one leg off the ground, which is very similar to running, you've got one leg down, one leg up, now you've got triplanar stability that's required. And so when you're doing a single leg deadlift, and then if you start to load it, the weight is trying to pull your pelvis out of position. You have to own that pattern and own it with all your core stabilizing muscles to make sure you don't fall out of it. So if I had to pick one drill, and it doesn't sound like a core exercise, but it really is, it would be the deadlift. And then from there, working to single leg deadlift. And then from there, working into more explosive patterns to train the core system. And we're talking like plyometric types of things, kettlebell swings, box jumps, all kinds of stuff along those lines. Now, there's fundamental levels we can get into where we're doing things on all fours, like quadruped diagonals, bird dogs, half kneeling chops and lifts. But I think at the root of it, we have to make sure that our hips and core are correct and we're focusing in on that hip hinge. And it's a big misnomer, and this is one of my pet peeves that I feel like
talk about it
in the endurance world. I feel like endurance athletes are afraid to lift heavy. I think we think, or maybe other people have placed this in our minds, like we're going to break because we are these sagittal plane beasts. We train a lot. We, you know, in the endurance world, you look at an endurance athlete and they're maybe more of a slight build. They don't look like your 100 meter sprinter athlete that's muscle bound, but at the same time, we're not weak athletes. I think we need to train endurance athletes with load, but we have to earn the right. As endurance athletes, you have to earn the right to load. So it's not like you just, okay, they just said on this podcast, I need to load heavier. It's not like you just jump in the weight room and you start moving a bunch of weight. He said, I need a deadlift, so I'm going to just go for it. You have to earn that right by clearing your patterns and knowing that you're going into that load with a good platform to load. And then again, don't be afraid to load. And because the nice thing about when you add heavier weight is that the drills often become more self-limiting. So in order to do that and move that weight correctly, you have to do it. You have to do it right. Otherwise you fail. And so there's some of these drills where I think you can create a scenario or a situation where you have to load or you have to engage things the right way. Otherwise there's no way you're going to perform that movement. And that's the thing I like to get into with athletes is getting them in a safe way to that place where they can load heavy and they're not afraid to load a little bit heavier.
Just following several professional endurance athletes on Instagram, on Facebook, I mean, Elizabeth James included, I follow Gwen Jorgensen. I think of Sebastian Kienle. I think of Ben Knute. I mean, I've seen several of them, you know, post from the gym and from their time doing work in the gym, and they are strong. They've got those 16 pack abs. They are lifting, to your point, BJ, under supervision with very proper form. They are lifting some heavy weight in different ways. And yeah, they're endurance athletes who are as good as they are because they are also putting in some serious strength training and not afraid to be a frail little endurance athlete. So great point there, BJ. And I want to ask you this too, BJ, because we talked about that box that is our core and you referenced how it starts at the top up at our diaphragm and it goes, you know, all the way down. There's a lot included in there. And so our core does quite a bit more than just help our arms and legs spin around correctly. You know, a strong core helps us control things like our diaphragm. It helps us control our bladder, having a good core. So BJ, talk to us about some of the other benefits of maintaining a healthy core.
Well, I mean, these two topics could be entire podcasts in and of themselves. I think it's super important. And unfortunately, we don't have all the time right now to talk about these two that they need the due diligence, need the due time. But I think, you know, especially with the diaphragm, I mean, many treatment paradigms have been built centering around the diaphragm and resetting this critical core muscle. It's why I feel like yoga has so much power. I mean, the getting back to the reset of breathing correctly can be a huge part of that timing of our core system. One of the most sore times in my life after a workout has been after doing a yoga session with my sister-in-law. She's a yoga instructor. And I woke up, I felt great that day. I woke up the next day and my core muscles, my abs felt so sore in a way as I've never felt before.
Oh yeah.
And at the time I'm like, it was just this focused breathing. And, you know, I was putting myself in positions I hadn't been in forever, but there's so much power in that. There's a ton of power. And it wasn't, I didn't touch a single weight at that point. And so that's part of that reset, like we're talking about, before you would even consider maybe loading through weight, going and making sure you've checked those boxes on proper diaphragm function, proper breathing function. And so there's a lot there. But and then going to the second part, when we talk about the bottom of the box, the pelvic floor, again, a very overlooked area that a lot of people don't like to talk about because oftentimes it leads to incontinence issues. And it's kind of an embarrassing subject for some people to talk about. But I can tell you in the clinic, it's so very common. So many people struggle with that, but a lot of people don't talk about it. And there's specific ways to train your pelvic floor to build that system. And honestly, these two areas in the diaphragm and the pelvic floor, is sometimes where people need to start. They need to start there before they do any of those other things we just discussed. They need to start with proper breathing, proper pelvic floor function. And, you know, I see it all the time. I've experienced it with athletes all the time where they get done with a race and they've just completely turned themselves inside out. They go to hug their knees after a race and, you know, there's a continence issue and they let their bladder go a little bit. And those are signs. Those can start to become signs that there are some things going on there that should be looked into. And there's professionals within the PT world. I know there's professionals in the PT world that they specialize. They build their practice completely around that specialization to train that. So there's definitely professionals that can help there, but I would highly recommend that people pursue those two avenues of the breathing and pelvic floor. And again, we'll probably talk about this more in the future because they're hot topics to discuss, but definitely an important point.
So training for a swim, bike, and run, I mean, it's already a time commitment. You know, so as we've talked about leg injuries, shoulder injuries, and now core injuries, and we hear that we need to do strength work to keep those areas healthy, plus we need to take some time to stretch, foam roll, we can do yoga, et cetera. It all eats up time that a lot of triathletes just don't always have. So BJ, help us set a proper expectation for how much of this we need to be doing on top of the swim, bike, and run. How much time should we spend strengthening and maintaining our body?
Yeah, and this question is obviously individual. It depends on what your body needs. For some people, I know that they would receive way more performance gains by focusing on like 3 30-minute sessions per week instead of that extra 3 by 30-minute period being focused on swim, bike, and run training. I know they would get way more out of their already existing swim, bike, and run training if they pared back part of their training to account for time to spend on strength training. But practically speaking, you know, if we're in fairly good places, many of us can benefit from just maybe 10 to 15 minutes of corrective exercise work sprinkled into our week, maybe just a couple times a week. But it all comes back to making sure that what you're doing counts and matters. I would rather have somebody spend 10 minutes doing 2 or 3 drills that are exactly what their body needs versus 30 to 45 minutes of 10 drills that most of it was just fluff, or even most of it potentially is making them worse. Some people are going about it where they know they should do it. They're not quite sure what to do. So they just do a bunch of generic things that they haven't even known if their body needs it or not. It's like throwing paint on a wall, trying to make a picture. Like, they might luck out and one of those drills hits them where they need it, but oftentimes they might be just training their dysfunction. They're strengthening their dysfunction where it's actually setting them up for issues further down the road. So I think the time commitment is huge, and you can get a lot of benefit in a very short amount of time. But the key with that is, like we've talked before, it's be a sniper with your training. Like, know where your training needs to be, dial it in, aim for that specific drill. And even if it's just that one drill a couple times a week, that can go a long ways if it's the right drill for you.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Just a few episodes back, on episodes 130 and 131 to be exact, we talked about training and racing short course triathlon. If you have a sprint or Olympic coming up and have not heard those episodes, I highly encourage you to go check them out. Coaches Jeff Rains and John Mayfield download their knowledge for setting yourself up for short course success. For those episodes, I reached out to our TriDot ambassadors to see if anyone had some recent stories from their own short course racing. We had loads of good submissions, and for today's cooldown, I wanted to share one that came from athlete Tucker Killam from Sacramento, California. Here is his story of using another competitor for motivation to dig deep at the Folsom Lake Olympic Tri.
Hey, Tucker Kellum here, out in Sacramento, California. Wanted to give a quick story about an Olympic distance triathlon I did in 2021. Towed the line out here at Folsom Lake in Folsom, California, just east of Sacramento. So the swim went off. everything went well, sighted well. Lots of folks were zigzagging and backstroking around, but made it through lots of scrums and finished maybe seventh or eighth out of the water total. We cranked, got in our saddles and clipped in, and then no kidding, three or four pedal strokes later, I heard a ping sound, and I looked down and thought my chain had slipped off the ring and just needed to be put on, like it happens, shifting from a big to small chain ring, but I couldn't even see the chain, so I wondered, where did this go? Looked back, and 20 feet behind me was the chain sitting on the ground, broken, completely snapped. So went over, walked over in disbelief, and was just like, great, my race is over. Am I going to have to borrow a mountain bike, or what am I going to do? Just completely distraught after all the training and to have it be stuck there. So luckily, there's a bike mechanic tent right there at transition. And so luckily, the mechanic was feeling hopeful, and he finally got it going 5 minutes later. So I thought, okay, we're good to go. Let's get back on and just make up for that time. Pretend like the swim was 5 minutes slow, and let's just go out and bike like hell. And got back on the bike and just started flying past folks. Ended up getting at a really good pace, but then even though I was cranking it, some guy in his lime green Zoot tri-suit passed me and just kept going further and further away. I was like, how is this guy going so fast when I'm pushing it as fast as I can go? So I tried the whole bike leg to try to catch him, and I just couldn't even see him after a while. And so I was thinking, okay, where is this green suit guy? Where is this green suit guy? So get to the run transition, fly off the bike, jump into my shoes, and just start cranking away. And then lo and behold, on the U-turn to come back to the finish line halfway on the run, I see the green suit guy. So on the U-turn, I cut on the inside of the path and actually passed him. He was on my tail the whole entire return back for the next 2 miles. And so on an uphill, I had to power walk because my legs were fried from pushing so hard. He passed me on the uphill. Then I stayed on his tail for the next couple of miles. And so we were probably 3/4 of a mile to the finish line. There was a fork in the road, and I decided now was the time to go. I was on his heel the whole entire time. So I pushed it, passed him on that little fork. The paths joined again, and then he was on my heel. Could then get to the last 1/4 of a mile and see the finish line, looking over my shoulder and seeing that bright lime green in right 5 feet behind me. Was terrifying and exhilarating. So hustle, sprint at the end, the finish line folks were cheering, and I just, you know, completely threw it all out there had the legs to kick at the end and finish really 4 seconds ahead of him to finish on the podium too, by the way, for the last spot on the podium. So getting third in the age group over the Zoot suit guy was a tremendous accomplishment, just an incredible, incredible experience, and still by far my favorite race. And really, if anything is going to break, it will. And you got to figure out how to set your mind straight, recover from that, and then really put that behind you and use that for motivation to just forge ahead and really throw the hammer down and have a good race. So, thanks for letting me share. And it just leaves room for what we can improve on or what I can improve on, and then put all of those lessons learned and growth to the next races. So, all right, signing off.
Well, that's it for today, folks. I want to thank Dr. BJ Leeper and pro triathlete Elizabeth James for talking about our core. Shout out to Precision Fuel and Hydration for partnering with us on today's episode. Remember that you can go to precisionfuelandhydration.com and you can use their free sweat test, the free quick carb calculator, and you can book a free one-on-one video consultation with a member of their team, and then use code TRIDOT10 at the checkout when you make your purchase. Enjoying the podcast? Have any triathlon questions or topics you want to hear us talk about? Head to triathlon.com/podcast and let us know what you're thinking. We'll do it all again soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com. and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.